persuaded to say, yes, I am one of those two. I must have this thing. All right, so speaking tonight for us is Teresa Fair from California. Thank you so very much. Warm welcome, and I'll hand it over to you.
Hello. Hi, everyone. Sorry, I was here. Suddenly, Mom and my nephew is calling. I have my nephew on the line. Interesting enough, helping him with doing an inventory before taking an action. That's pretty impressive, folks. I got sponsees who don't do that. My nephew was like, I need to do an inventory before I hurt somebody real quick. I'm like, okay. And he's 18. I got sponsees. I'm like, still don't do it. Okay. Anyway, how much time do I have to share? I don't hear you, Billy.
Till 5 of.
Till 5 of. Okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Teresa. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober because of a loving God. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in my recovery and to your meeting. I have to tell you, honestly, I like when it's small little meetings. I just do. I know I've done many with like hundreds and thousands, but I totally dig little intimate meetings. I don't know. There's something about that I like. I always begin my share with telling you honestly how I'm feeling at the moment. It just helps to take the power out of it. And I do this often, but it's awkward and uncomfortable. I feel intimidated and extremely vulnerable. My head tells me I have so many other things to get done in this hour than to be talking to you. I'm also a student, and today is Sunday, so I have an assignment, an exam that's due by 11:59, and I've been at Big Book Study, and then I always end up talking to people right afterwards, and I'm watching the time. I'm trying to be present, but I'm like, okay, that took away that window, that assignment, so I've got that going on. And I want to be present for all of you, but I'm like, oh my God, I got things to do. I got to feed Mom. So that's going on in my head. So I have to say that out loud. But despite that that's happening, that I think I have other things to do far more important that seems urgent, and that I'm nervous, uncomfortable, intimidated, and feel extremely vulnerable, I do it because my life depends on it. This is a life and death errand. Somebody did it for me. I don't know what was going on with them, but I know when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, people were sharing, and I don't know. I'm in AA, right? I don't even know where I'm at anymore. I'm like, is this my Al-Anon share? Where am I? Okay. I'm getting upset some Al-Anons, boy, if I start out with that. maybe like all these alcoholics have infiltrated our meeting. You know, I know that they did it for me, and I'm not sure if their sponsor made them do it, or they didn't want to, or they were sick to their stomach as normally I am. I just know they did it. And so that's why I'm here. I would say thank you for doing a 12-step call on me, because when it's all said and done, I'm going to feel lighter on my feet, extremely grateful that I'm sober and pumped up. Boy, I'm going to be pumped up for the rest of the day. I always say sometimes it feels like a one-night stand. You know, in the end, I'm like, I don't know if it was good for you, but it was good for me. I hope you got yours, because I know I'm getting mine. I know that sounds terrible, but it's so true. Because I'm participating in my recovery. I always think about that. You know what I mean? Bill said, if I don't talk to another drunk, I'm going to get drunk. He didn't say if I don't get another drunk sober. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of how this program works. So I'm staying sober today. My sobriety date, let's start with that. My sobriety date is March 29th. I had a birthday not too long ago. March 29, 1990. But for the grace of God, the fellowship, the big book, 12 steps, 12 and 12, fellowship. I say it takes a village. But for the grace of a loving God and the mustard seed of willingness and taking some action, I have had the honor and the privilege of being with you all for the last 31 years. That is crazy. You know, I'm 31 came up on me pretty fast. I was still processing 30. You know, it was like, and we got to 31. I was like, what? Hold on a second. I am now sober longer than I was drinking. I came to you at the age of 24, going on 25. I'm now 55 years old. I'll be 56 in July. I am more present and awake and aware than ever before. This program has become a working part of my mind and my body. But I don't ever want to forget her. I remember telling my sponsor some years ago that I was, because I felt so far removed, right, from what it was like, that it was a story. It seemed as though I talk about myself in third person. And as I share about that, what it was like, it's a story. It's this narrative. And I told her I was worried that I was going to forget her, you know? And she told me, don't ever have to worry about that because there's a thing called memory, you know? And so I pray that I always remember her. And more importantly, I pray that I never forget my last drunk, because that's what you told me. And as long as I can remember my last drunk, I'll keep coming back. And I get an opportunity to share what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And if you knew, there's a reason for that. In our literature, it talks about a message of depth and weight. It is the language of the heart. I believe it's the music that we find in these rooms, that nobody else can do what we do with one another. It captured my attention. You captured mine. That no lover, no family member, no therapist, no counselor could have ever captured my attention. And you've continued to capture it. I'm still in awe of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to welcome our new friends. Welcome home. We've been praying for you. I heard that when I got here, that there's a moment of silence and prayer, and it takes place in every meeting all over the world, and that prayer is for you. But for the grace of God, you've been lifted up and brought into these rooms, and it's not your idea, and you don't get credit for this one. You've been given a gift, and it's a gift unearned. We ask you to keep coming back. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens, and let us love you so you can learn to love yourself. It's going to be all right. I heard you don't have to take a drink again if you want to, and more importantly, even if you don't want to. And this program really does work. And I always wish the newcomer the gift of desperation. If you be alcoholic like me, unfortunately, that's what it takes. I'm certainly the chronic alcoholic. I'm not the one that's like, oh my goodness, alcohol is causing problems. Perhaps I should go to AA and get it resolved. That's a different type of alcoholic. Anyway. And even though the newcomer is the most important person in the room, and truly you are, we need you. Certainly the newcomer reminds me of why I keep coming back. I'm so grateful for all of you. I always joke around and say, please don't get it twisted. The reason why I watch the news, I believe, is because I'm hoping that one day science will accomplish it. I'm always listening out to see if they start a miracle pill yet or what. And you are important. But I don't know where I would be if it wasn't for the old timers. So for all the old timers in the house, thank you for my life and my sobriety. I still want what you have, and I don't ever want to lose that. I get always get emotional because I'm glad we don't get that well around here, that we don't have to keep coming back to carry this message. That when I came here, I saw people who have been here before me, and I watched them still sweeping the floors and putting up the chairs and extending their hands. They're usually the most quiet person in the room, unless they're the bleeding deacon. And they have these one-word slogans, you know? And some of them in our home group have these little trinkets. I don't know if you guys have it in yours. I haven't gotten the memo yet, but I always feel like after 30, I don't know, they get a trinket store or something. Like, old-timers always give you like a pickle, you know, or a mirror that says you're looking at the problem. whenever you ask them a question, we used to ask Herb King, man. He was one of the oldest old timers. He had like 50 something years. And you go to him and be like, how'd you do it? How'd you do it? You know, and he'd be like, one day at a time. He'd be like, that was deep, you know. Thank you, Herb. That's some level of spiritual maturity, man. The less you say, the more profound it is. And there's another thing that I'm attracted to in our home group. And I don't know if most of you appreciate this, but somehow I do. And that I've always found it interesting that most of the old timers in our meeting, not only do they sit in that same seat week after week. I don't know if y'all had that when you was, I thought that was kind of cool. But most of them been together for the last 30, 40 years. And some of them still don't like one another. And there's something about that I don't know why I dig. You know what I mean? I'm like, I don't know what that was that attracted me to that. I think it let me know that this wasn't a popularity contest, that this was a life and death errand I associated with being in an emergency room. I don't recall leaving the emergency room because I didn't like the people around me. I just needed to see the doctor. And so I appreciated that they kept coming back despite that, that principle that we have, that the only requirement is a desire to want to stop drinking and we all belong. And I learned that you don't have to like me, but you get to love me and we get to be of service with one another. So that's what I learned from them. I'm going to give you a Reader's Digest in a short period of time of what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. And I invite you to listen to similarities and not the differences. And you get to ask yourself some questions like, that happened to me. I felt that way too. And most importantly, perhaps this program can work for me. My mind is still in this place, and I'm just going to share from here, because I was just talking to someone who asked me to work with them, and we were talking about the disease of alcoholism. And as I was talking to her and we were going over the doctor's opinion, and I kept emphasizing what I believe has been, I don't want to say brainwashed, but what was taught to me was to examine my relationship with alcohol. And that the very first step in recovery was to concede to my innermost self that I was truly alcoholic. And that I wasn't calling myself an alcoholic because I had problems with alcohol. I didn't call myself an alcoholic because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing, I guess the first item on the agenda was to find out what alcoholism was. I didn't even know what it was. What is it? And then do I have it? And as I began examining my relationship with alcohol and then lining it up, like connecting the dots and comparing it to alcoholism, I tell people, I don't know about you, but I was like, I'm scared. Are you scared? Because alcoholism is scary. I'm sorry, it is the most insidious illness. It's the only illness that tells me I don't have it. I remember my sponsor telling me I may not be responsible for my disease, but I'm responsible for my recovery. And as I began looking at when did I start drinking, what did that look like? What did it do to me and for me? It scared the living daylights out of me. I come from generations of alcoholics. When we talk about alcoholic life being a normal life, my alcoholic life was a normal life. I only had 4 family members who weren't drinkers. I can tell you who they were: my cousin Petra, my grandmother, my father, and my brother. If anything, they were the black sheep of the family, right? Nobody wanted to be like them. As a matter of fact, you know, nobody was like, look forward to when they showed up. You know, it's like, oh, I don't even know how they survived us, man. Like, we were like, oh, you know, here they come. I mean, it was just, it's interesting that in sobriety, though, they were the ones that I leaned towards, you know? when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you began to give me adjectives for my experience because I certainly didn't have the vocabulary for it. But what I learned was that what you say, I come from a dysfunctional family. As far as I know, it's my family. This is still my family to this day. I believe that they're colorful. They make me laugh. They're happy drunks and miserable ones. They've been doing it for years. Not many of them are not planning on changing it. You know, like they're very comfortable in that insanity. I spent half the year in Puerto Rico and half the year in New York. And I didn't see anything different in both of these islands. The very thing that went on in New York was the very thing that went on in the island of Puerto Rico. And we are Puerto Ricans and we love salsa and rice and beans, you know? And we're proud that we own the Bacardi factory. We go there like Disneyland, man. We went to Bacardi factory and when they got Kmart, those are the two vacation places. You get dressed up and you go to the Bacardi factory. I think they stopped doing this, but it was because they gave free little bottles. So you got online and you went in and you smelled and you drank and tasted and then you got the bottles and you went back online and you did it again. I had a lot of family members who were drug addicts. I don't remember being embarrassed about any of them or it wasn't humiliating. What I knew was that my uncles that were heroin addicts, they would be in the middle of a conversation, they would nod out, and when they come back, they will finish where they left off. I mean, it was just, they took a commercial break, it was a pause. And so I don't remember being appalled by it. If anyone came to visit, I'd be like, don't worry, he'll be back in a minute and he'll finish his point. You know what I mean? And he'll just, right where he left off, right? I had a lot of family members who were doing time in state penitentiary, federal. It wasn't a horrible thing. As a matter of fact, I think you needed to know that I have family members who were serving time in prison so that if you looked at me funny, you needed to know who I knew. You know what I'm saying? Like, you need to be careful how you talk to me because my uncle just came out on attempted murder. So you might want to change. You know what I mean? How are you dealing with me right now? Because it's almost like I remember my brother told a nurse one time he checked himself out of the hospital. And he told her, I always laugh about this. My brother told her, if anything happens to me, my family's going to come back and kill you and everybody in your phone book. That's my family. You call it dysfunctional. That's my family. We have family members that are, you know, we call mafioso, you know, cartel, gangsters, whatever you want to call it, pimps, dealers, hustlers. And we also have family members that are police officers, politicians, and priests. So as far as I know, they're all the same. So it's not like I just grew up with these seedy group of people. You know what I mean? We were in our community. And so it was more like Scarface kind of thing. It was pretty cool. I don't know where I'm going with this, but let's have fun. So I remember not too long ago, a few years ago, I went to speak in Puerto Rico. That was amazing. And one of my members from my home group came with me. And he was saying, you know, sometimes he feels people embellish their stories a little bit, you know, because we can kind of do that. In our home group, we try to out-bottom one another, you know. Somebody's like, I've been in jail. And somebody's like, I've been in state penitentiary, you know, that kind of thing. So we get to Puerto Rico and I take him to see my family. And he came back and he was like, she wasn't kidding. He was scared. I was like, I remember one of my cousins, I said, okay, I'm going to go and see Nancy. And he was like, you better strap up like Pancho Vera. You know what I mean? Anyway, he was nervous. He was like, I don't want to see Nancy. And then we went to see my family. And we're like literally in a compound, you know, with everybody with guns. It's like that movie thing. And he was like, oh, I was like, take a chill pill. You know what I'm saying? You need to act right. So you call that dysfunctional. That's my family. I respect them. I remember in the program, you guys talked about an inventory, and I was like, that's a hit list. I've been doing that one for years. The only thing I don't do is the fourth column. So even my cousins will call me and be like, what's going on with you over there in California? And I'm like, they got a thing called the hit list, but I can't share it with you until I do my fourth column and talk to my sponsor. Anyway, I have to laugh. The conversations that we have at our table is hysterical. We still have conversations today. And where most of you can't wait to get your family back, I've had to stay away from the majority of mine. They'll rub off on me before I rub off on them. The other adjective you guys gave me, and that was called physical abuse. I grew up with everybody beating me and doing what they want to do to me. The other one was verbal abuse and sexual abuse. That was a normal form of communication. My mother's an alcoholic. I was born addicted to alcohol and pills, mommy pill popper. And alcohol was given to me as an infant. So I've been getting loaded since fetus, since conception. And I'm not alone. You know, the majority of my cousins were born like that too. And the only thing to get me to stop crying was alcohol. So that's what they gave me. And so I was loaded on my first year birthday, second year birthday. I mean, I drank every day, all day. The interesting thing about that, when I look at what differentiates me from the average tempered drinker, what makes me different from the problem drinker or the abuser of alcohol, and where I'm not confused in any way, shape, or form that I am truly an alcoholic, is that I am bodily different. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. How else can an infant be given alcohol and a child other than milk, formula, and juice, and I not die? Under normal circumstances, you should not be talking to me. Instead of my body rejecting this poison, my body welcomed it. It's like Rocky Horror Show, man. Feed me, Seymour. You know what I'm saying? I didn't say, you know, I didn't spit it out. I didn't do nothing like that. My mother's intention was hoping that I would die from alcohol poisoning and crib death. According to mommy, you know, I'm a product of rape and she didn't want to have me and left me in the hospital. It's all this drama. But I survived. Here I am. And so when I tell you my alcoholic life is a normal life, I mean it, and not even symbolically, like literally, that's the only thing I ever knew. Alcohol was the oxygen that ran through my blood veins. It was everything that that's the only thing I ever knew. It wasn't later that my grandmother tried to introduce other things. There were soft foods and meals. I described the first things that I can not even recall, but as it's explained to me, was what I come to know now as a screwdriver. But she would open up an orange, the top of it, put rum inside, and I would drink the rum, and then she would open it up and I would eat. We call the carne, the meat. She would also, which I tried this is very tedious, talk about love. She would peel the skin off of green grapes, soak them in wine, and give me that. I still have issues with food. I can live on potato chips and chocolate. Some of my sponsees, when they hang out with me, they bring a sandwich and an apple because we hardly stop to get anything to eat. I'm learning and I'm getting better. Needless to say, I was always malnourished. I have immune deficiency. I lived in hospitals. The only time I got nutrition was through that clear bag, you know, that clear liquid bag. Why they returned me to the home, I have no idea. Maybe because it was in the 60s, who knows? I would just get, you know, back into the house and do the cycle over and over again. Nobody ever took me or removed me from the house. Today, as a result of that, I have new adjectives. And that is fibromyalgia, PTSD, anxiety, depression. Now menopause, that's a new experience. I'm like, and I'm present for it. Give me a minute. I still have immune deficiency. ever since COVID, man, this house has been locked down. I've been like, click, 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 click. Because on the normal circumstances, if you have a cold, I get pneumonia. It just automatically that happens. And so I lived like that for 24 years. I don't remember doing a New Year's resolution. I didn't say tomorrow's going to be different. I don't remember switching anything. I certainly can see the progression of my disease through extracurricular activity as I got older. The very character defects you've asked me to remove around here, I was breeded on them. I believe it's impossible to survive the world I come from without it. I always say to this day, I'm not able to go around my family and talk about love and tolerance is our code. I mean, that's just hysterical. Even now when I try to talk to them, you know, I'll be trying to throw some AA nuggets, you know, the language. My cousins be like, I don't know about that, Terry. I'm like, anyway, where are you at fault? They'd be like, what? So what are you talking about? You've been in California too long. Physical abuse, verbal abuse, and sexual abuse, as horrific as that sounds, I wasn't present for my experience, folks. I don't know if alcohol spoke to you, but it spoke to me. And it told me if nobody loves you, I love you. You don't have to worry about any of this. It was like the three monkeys, see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. I was detached and disconnected. I had no heartbeat. I wasn't emotionally connected to the experience. As a matter of fact, most of my story is other people's stories. We talk about living in a blackout. The first 24 years of my life is a blackout. It's only been in the process of recovery and uncovering and discovering and an inventory that more and more has been revealed. Whenever I do meet some family members or high school or grammar school reunions, they tend to show up with pictures and they tell me stories. Or if I have particular flashes that come to me, I used to call my brother and he would fill in all the blanks. I wasn't planning on changing that life. I really wasn't. Nobody got in between me and my booze. Alcohol told me when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed at night. Where I was gonna live, where I wasn't gonna live. If I was going to work and if I was not. If I was in a relationship and if I was not, and who I was in a relationship with, it dictated every single area of my life. I had a spreadsheet, I had a budget, and my budget had a line item of whatever substances I needed. It went along with rent, food, shelter. Wasn't planning on changing it. As I got older, I said I lived like Michelle Pfeiffer on Scarface. I was into money, property, and prestige. I knew how to hang out in Harlem, and I knew how to hang out in Wall Street. I made money, had money. I had furs, diamonds. I learned that if I dress up my outsides, that was the only thing that mattered. I never knew I was dying on the inside. The well never went dry. I didn't share. This is mine, you get yours. And I sipped my drinks. I didn't chug a lug. I didn't dance butt naked on tables. I sipped. My mother was the drunk. She was a mess. Thank God for good sponsorship. I remember when I came here, I said, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. I was looking at the differences rather than the similarities. And I told my sponsor, I don't know about one's too many and a thousand's not enough. And she took me to downtown Skid Row to introduce me to myself. Because if you've been drinking as long as I have, my tolerance level had changed a long time ago. I only need a little bit. My entire bloodstream was filled with alcohol. And so as long as I had a sip, it was sufficient and I would sip and it would never run out. Until for whatever reason, at the age of 24, the only way I can describe it is that alcohol betrayed me, abandoned me, and left me emotionally retarded with no coping skills. Now, I've heard a lot of stories in these rooms. But somehow I believe this is where most of us, where it's kind of like where the road meets, because I've seen people with loving parents, wonderful upbringing, to the point that since my nephews were little, I would always ask them, because you tell me this is the disease of perception, I would ask them since they were children, I would say to them, what's your perception? You know what I'm saying? Do you feel love? Do you feel a part of? But somehow something happens where, as I understand it, that my mind began to do, I began to notice that my mind had only one of two thoughts, how to or how not to. So it was dominated by how to get some, how not to get some. I knew that I would become restless, irritable, and discontent unless I would take that sip. But now I'm taking that sip and I'm still restless, irritable, and discontent. I got a problem with that. Many people talk about burning bridges. I didn't burn any bridges. I didn't establish any. Now I wanted to know, where was everybody at? I walked in a bar and I heard them say, look what the trash brought in. How long they been saying that? I can't tell you how long they said it, but I remember when I heard it. And I tried to laugh it off, but I couldn't shake it off. Something happened in here. It just wasn't right. I always went up and down alleys at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I dare you to come up on me. It's the little people you need to worry about. I don't worry about the big people. But now all of a sudden I'm going up and down the alleys and I'm paranoid. I didn't take a paranoid class, people. I didn't know what was going on with me. I noticed that there was a bright light and it was extremely bright and it burned and it hurt my eyes. And I asked somebody, what is that? They were like, it's the sun. I didn't even know what that was. It was as though I had been living in a coma and now I'm resuscitated and I'm now present in this thing you call life and I had never been here. Never. Scared the living daylights out of me. You say alcohol stops working, I say it betrayed me. I started to try to find any combination necessary to get me flatline again. And no matter what I did, I was still present for my experience. I think that's a game changer. You see, I'm not mad at people who can have a drink and have a good time. I'm not mad at you. That's why I'm not mad at my family. They're having fun. The consequences don't matter. Consequences don't get my attention. Usually the alcoholic is the last one to even notice. I'm oblivious. But when I begin to notice, when I can't shake it off, you use terms like remorse and guilt. I don't have that language. I just know I'm uncomfortable. My bottom lasted 6 months. And the best thing I can come up in the end was to invite death in my life, and death wouldn't even take me out. I got a problem with that. I don't know how to do another 24 like that. I don't know how to do another 24 hours being present for my experience. And because death didn't take me out, I ended up in a church. And here is where I believe the gift of desperation and the grace of God meet one another. Where the grace of God becomes visible. And the 12 and 12, it says, only an act of providence can help a drunk like me. But for the grace of God, I stand before you sober today. I didn't step in that church with the vocabulary of being surrendered or done. I know I was tired. I was tired of doing that over and over and over again. And I felt the presence in that church. And I knew that the presence that I felt was distinctly separated from me. And I said a prayer that's perhaps different than any other prayer. I know that it came from the depths of my soul. I said, God, please allow me to feel the peace that I feel in this church inside of me. I needed one moment for my head to shut up, my skin to stop crawling, and for my stomach to stop turning, just for a minute, man. I always say I lost my hustle, yo. I had no idea that prayer was going to change my life. I didn't know what I was praying to. I didn't even know anything was listening to me. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because you have a tradition. It's called attraction rather than promotion. My mother is sober and my cousin. And I remembered you people. I went to my dad, I asked for help, and I remembered you people. My mother and my cousin been here for 4 years. I didn't know a seed was being planted. Maybe you messed up my drinking. I don't even remember paying attention to you, but I remembered you. I remembered your smiles, your laughter, the warmth and the camaraderie that you have with one another. I remember you never shunned me, roll your eyes at me, suck your teeth at me, or try to shove a pamphlet down my throat. And for that, I'm truly grateful. I arrived in downtown Los Angeles on March 29, 1990, wearing a size 1 pair of pants, 2 pants underneath, a huge sweatshirt, 4 months pregnant. I didn't have a heartbeat by the time I got here. That was the 4th child I had lost. My mother picked me up and dropped me off in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober in 9604 Crenshaw Llano. This is my first time in the program. I believe it's important to tell the newcomers that there are some of us that stay. In our big book, it says 50% of us who really try stay, so it is possible. Immediately, I learned that relapse is not a part of a recovery, that relapse is part of the disease of alcoholism, and this is the one place that I understand why somebody drinks again. I was just sharing that with the new person. Today, what I've come to learn is I don't say, I'm not going to drink again. I can't drink again. I won't drink again. Because I understand what I suffer from, what I tell you is I'm going to drink again because that's what I do. I have an illness. Untreated, I'm drinking again. When I came into these rooms, I was lost. I was confused. The world as I had known it had changed. It flipped the switch on me. And I am present and I don't know how to live. And if you people can't help me, somebody need to blow my brains out. I'm not doing another 24 like that. I believe the innocence, the desperation, the vulnerability. When I came to you, I had no more chips in the game. I had no more straws to draw. I had no more cards to bluff with. This is it. You can't help me. I don't know what to do. Hello, sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't come in here with any more genius ideas. I had attempted all of them. I would say, I feel like a baby in a baby basket left at the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the old timers that picked up that basket. They brought me into the rooms and they began to spoon feed me this thing called recovery. I'm so grateful nobody ever apologized for their relationship with God when I got here. They knew distinctly and clearly what they suffered from, and they shared it with me. And I began to connect the dots. And I'm telling you, I was like, I'm scared. Are you scared? They gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, told me it was a textbook. It was meant to be studied. It was not a novel. This is not an intellectual program. This was a spiritual program of action. Now, people call it Nazi, and everybody's sensitive. You know what? I don't know how they talk to other people. I know how they talk to me, and I know what I heard. They told me, if you ain't done, there's the door. Do some controlled drinking. We'll be back here if you make it back. That's a good proposition. Nobody told me I had to do anything. Nobody. This is what we have done. This is what we have found. If you want what we have, then you do what we do. You follow the black on the white. You identify based on your experience, and then you do what it says. Literally, that is the simplicity of this program. They used to say, keep it simple, stupid. Now, I know everybody's very sensitive. We don't say stupid today. I remember if I would go to the old timers and I would go, I think, they would go, that's the problem. I heard stinking thinking committee. Don't listen to the stinking thinking committee in between your ears. And I literally used to go to meetings and talk to myself out loud on the bus. And I would say, oh, you shut up. They told me about you. I'm not talking to you. You're my disease. I'm going to a meeting and I'm calling my sponsor. They told me about you. You're trying to set me up. I began with my sponsor. They gave me a sponsor. I didn't pick her, interview her, fire her, hire her. I'm glad they didn't ask me to do that. I did get sassy real quick. I was like, I thought you're supposed to find somebody you identify with. They were like, you now identify with her. So that was the end of that. All my little sassiness was like short-lived. I was like, oh, well, there goes that. Never mind. All I needed to know about my sponsor was that she had a working knowledge of the steps in the book. I learned the traditions long before the steps. I'm a member because I say I am. I don't know about you, but that was a big deal to me. I belong because I say I am. I have a desire. They still make fun of me in my home group. I used to walk around telling people, I'm a member. You have to help me. I don't like you either, okay? But I have a desire, all right? So you have to help me. I learned principles before personalities. I need to set my personality to the side. Check it at the door. Self-knowledge serves me nothing. I had to leave my IQ, my resume at the door. Serves nothing. I had to find this relationship with God. Where was I to find it? You gave me a hint. You said deep down inside in every man, woman, and child was the fundamental idea of God. It lived inside of me. All my life, I've reached outside of myself. It's no one that always came up short. Money, property, prestige, alcohol, drugs, relationships, all my life, reaching out, reaching like religion, different religious programs, different philosophies, all my life, coming up short. Lived inside of me. How do I get there? Through the steps. I was in awe of the power that you found here. But you see, the power that you found gave you back the power of choice. The power that you found doesn't ask for very much. All the higher powers that I had in my life before took away my power of choice. All the higher powers that I had relied on, including the God of reason, robbed me of my dignity, my integrity, my self-respect, my morals, and my values. The people that I love, my hopes, and my dreams. But the one that you found here gave you all that back and then some. And as I began to incorporate these steps in my life, I learned they weren't homework. They're not homework assignments. I didn't spend time with my sponsor going, that's very interesting. Let me see if I get that. I agree with that. I don't. I was like, I don't know. I'm just going to do whatever it is that you guys said and let me see what happens. The less it made sense, the better off I was. And you know what? The big book hasn't lied to me. I've watched something happen to Teresa. I don't know about sending boundaries, you guys, and finding a voice and all this kind of stuff. I get it. I've gotten outside help. I know where that language comes from. But in the program of action that is outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you give me a blueprint, right? Follow the black on the white. You give me the treasure map. And if I follow this treasure map, something happens. And I end up having what you call a psychic change, that I cannot differentiate the true from the false. My perception is distorted. And so the lenses begin to click into place. And as I am willing to get rid of everything and anything that stands in the way of what it is, all of a sudden, I begin to see things differently. I remember going to old timers, they used to ask me, what step are you on? And I would say 8 or 9 or whatever, 5. They say, talk to me when you get to step 10, because that's when sanity returns. Until then, you are cocoa for Cocoa Puffs, okay? And so I would just was willing to get to step 10 so that sanity could return and I can have a conversation with most of you and act like I knew something, right? Because anything up until then was going to be based on my resentments and my fears. And let me tell you, I have been so excited, enthusiastic about a program of action. Have I been excited, enthusiastic about life all the time? No. I am not one of those that tell you I recovered and everything is just fantastic. No, no, no. I'm like, hold up. I've learned around here what it is to love. You've opened up my heart as a result of cleaning house, and I've learned what it is to love. I've learned about unconditional love, to be loved, to love others. What a beautiful thing, this thing called love. I've also learned what it is to be heartbroken. Ouch. Oh, man. I've learned what it is to laugh. I love laughing. My nephews crack up. They're like, Titi, you're always laughing at yourself. And I've also learned what it is to cry, to wail. I've been to meetings where I say, if you tell me this too shall pass one more time, I'm going to punch you in the face. Okay? I need to know what I'm going to do in the meantime. Welcome to the land of the living. I learned to put one hand in God and one hand in this program. They have burned into my consciousness. Trust God, clean house. Trust God, clean house. Be of service. I don't know how not to give this program away. You tell me the only thing that ensures permanent sobriety is work on another alcohol. If sex is troublesome, work on another alcohol. I work with a lot of people. It's not impressive. I'm sicker than most. My phone rings like central office. When I say, God, take all of me, what will you have me be? What will you have me do? I met God butt naked alone with a white flag up my ass. I don't know how to make that sweeter. I'm sorry about the bad word, but that's how I met God, okay? Butt naked alone with a white flag up my butt. What are we doing? I don't know nothing. One of the greatest gifts you've given me is the word I don't know. And the longer I stay sober, the less I know. I usually tell people, don't hold me to what I'm telling you today. It might change next week, right? Next week, I'll be like, remember what I told you last week? I was so full of it. I know it sounded deep, but I don't know what I was talking about. It sounded good at the time. Thank God we're not all crazy on the same day. This is the one place I just get to be. I get to come to you broken, confused, and lost. There are times I can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, so I look for somebody with a flashlight or I follow your voice until I find it. And when I said, what will you have me be? What will you have me do? I've been the caretaker and the caregiver to most of my perpetrators and my abusers. I've practiced this thing called forgiveness and compassion. My spiritual muscles have been stretched. I've watched God shape and mold me into a woman of dignity, of integrity, and self-respect. I get to pass this on to the next generation because what happens around here, the miracles that take place, is not only that I'm not drinking today, but the thought has been removed without any effort on my part. But there's a disclaimer. It's contingent upon my spiritual condition. As I told you about my nephews, I'm gonna end with a couple of things. I think about the ripple effect that happens around here. I was just talking to my nephew last night. He called me again today, but I was talking about how they haven't even come close to the life that my brother and I lived. They have the gift of discernment, trust and intuitive thought. They say things like, I'm uncomfortable and I love you. They have hopes and they have dreams and they have aspirations. They believe in possibility. They know what healthy people are like and unhealthy people, and they have the ability to stand in their own. And that to me is a direct result of how I've walked and lived this program. Not that I talked it, but I've lived it and they've watched it. I'm a student today. I'm a daughter. I'm a partner. I'm a friend. I'm an aunt. I've experienced a lot of things in the last few years. I've had a lot of losses, right? My brother, my father. Give me a minute. It's called grief. And don't deny me of that. That means I love them so much. The pain of losing them only tells me that I'm alive, you know what I mean? And present for their love, and I miss them. Sometimes I lose patience. I take care of my mom with Alzheimer's, and my mother's an alcoholic, right? She got 35 years, but she doesn't have meetings and a sponsor and steps, so y'all just got to give me a minute. Today, I always say she lives like we always did growing up. The only thing is that she has a different diagnosis. the other Alzheimer's. She does the same thing. And it was, anyway, now she gets to get away with it. Anyway, I'm probably over my time. I'm sorry, but I always like to end with this so I can always remember it. I do this so I can remember this. This woman, Marcy, told me when I got here that I had a beautiful light inside of me and we just need a clean house for that light to shine. And I believed her. And so I called God a show off. Takes a girl like me, unloved, unnecessary, and insignificant. Picks me up, dusts me off, and builds me up so you can see what it can do. Can't take any credit for it. I can't even pat myself on the back, man. All I brought to the table was a mustard seed of willingness. So I don't say if I can do it, you can do it. I say if this power can do this for me, could you imagine what it can do for you? I know I got another drink in me. I'm a real alcoholic. But every part of me tells me that if I drink again, I will die. And I'll never find you again. And I don't know how I can go back to that life knowing that this one exists. So because of that, despite circumstances, issues, situations, pain, sorrows, joy, happiness, I can have question marks in all areas of my life. But the one area I never want to have a question mark is that I am an alcoholic. Because knowing that, it keeps my feet firmly on the ground, that I stay in the middle of unity, recovery, and service. I keep suiting up and showing up, and I do a whole lot of no matter what. And I have moments where I'm like, uncle, uncle, uncle. But then the phone rings. And I talk to you, and I'm reminded that God is, and everything is going to be all right. If nobody told you they love you today, I truly, truly do. Again, you guys have no idea the 12-step call you've done for me today. I want to thank you for allowing the God in you to help discover the God in me so that I, in return, can do the same for others. Thank you so much for allowing me to participate in my recovery. Thank you.
Trying to unmute here. There we go. Hey, Teresa, thank you so much for coming out and sharing with our group today. What an energetic, enthusiastic, attractive share. And I'm going to wrap this thing up so everybody else can let you know about it. Are there any AA-related announcements this evening? All right. Our seven